Leave you with Batmobile. These cats, you know them. They're one of my favorites. You've heard them here on the Wrecking Hours before. It is from over there across the pond in Europe. Old school psychobilly for your listening pleasure. Catch me next week, same time, same channel.
WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
My name is Allison. This is my last semester at Duke University.
We are at Minneapolis Technical and Community
Mitchell
College.
State University in St. Paul.
First year at Lesley University.
I'm at University of North Carolina.
I'm a sophomore, I go to Morehouse College.
I'm Jasmine, I'm a freshman, and I'm at Harvard University.
I'm Jasmine, and I'm a freshman, and I'm at Harvard University.
You guys are both Jasmine?
Yeah.
Can I ask y'all some questions? This is for a show called Freakonomics Radio.
What? Of course. I'm an economics major and philosophy minor. Bring it.
Okay.
Jeffrey Williams from East Atlanta, Georgia.
Do you think college is worth it?
I feel like if a bunch of people from the community just sat in a park every day for 3 months straight and just exchanged books and had lectures, we'd learn much more than we had in 3 years here.
I guess when I came here, I was expecting, you know, I put a lot of time and effort and money into this, and, like, I want to get that out, and it's not, like, looking that way right away, so...
I always worry because of what the economy's like and everything, if I'm going to have a job, if there's going to be a job out there for me.
So in today's day, a college degree is what a high school diploma was, you know, decades ago.
You didn't really think about why you were going to college, just that you were going to.
Society forces you to think that because you go to college, you're going to be successful, and that's not true. You don't need college.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
This is the second of two episodes about the value of a college education. In part one, we heard Alan Ezel, a former FBI agent, talk about the huge market for fake degrees. Pretty much any diploma that you can imagine, even an MD, can be bought online.
You would be shocked at the number of people that buy this garbage and then put it on their resume and then post this online.
But mostly, we talked about real degrees. Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author, assured us that going to college definitely pays off in the long run.
One thing is clear, is that the market puts a tremendous reward on education. So the best estimates that economists have are that each extra year of education that you get is worth about maybe an 8% increment to your earnings each year for the rest of your life. So it turns out for most people, buying a lot of education is, or at least for the average person, let me say, buying a lot of education is a really good deal.
But let's acknowledge the obvious. Buying all that education has gotten a lot more expensive.
So if you're thinking about this as an investor...
That's David Card. He's an economist at the University of California, Berkeley.
You know, you've got a kid and you're thinking of sending them to college or not, you have to pay a lot of money up front and then reap those returns later on. And several features of that are difficult. One is the cost that you have to pay up front has gone up quite a bit. And the second is the uncertainty involved in whether the kid will actually successfully complete the degree. It's a pretty risky investment.
Hey, Beret, say hello.
Hi.
So Beret Lam works here at Freakonomics Central. She is the editor of the Freakonomics blog, among other things. And you are a fairly recent college graduate, yes?
Yes, I graduated in 2007 from the University of Chicago.
Good school. And you studied economics at Chicago, yes?
Yes, I did.
So economists always talk about the returns to education. That is, that a college degree hugely increases your chances of making a good living. So you must know these numbers by heart?
Of course. all of us know these numbers are, as college graduates, that they're on our side and that statistically college grads will make a lot more money over a lifetime than those who don't go to college.
And you take great comfort in knowing these numbers, I assume, yes?
More comfort when I was in college than now.
So what's the problem? Why do they offer less comfort now?
Well, these are numbers on average. And after graduation, a lot of my friends were struggling and many of them were unemployed or underemployed, and they weren't doing what they wanted to be doing. It was hard to look at those numbers.
Right. So the numbers in the aggregate paint this pretty great picture, but if you're not living that life, then it's not so pretty.
Right. I called up one of my friends to talk about this. His name is Luke Annable, and we graduated together from the University of Chicago.
What did Luke study economics as well?
No, he studied English.
Okay. And what's Luke doing for a job now?
Luke's a bartender in Tucson, Arizona.
All right, so let's hear what Luke had to say, yeah?
Has anybody asked you, what are you doing with your degree because of what you're doing?
I think so. I think my parents finally stopped asking that question, which is nice.
Yeah, I guess, you know, in the media and in general, there's this conversation about... whether college is worth it. I know you don't have second thoughts about that. You're glad you went.
Definitely.
What that next step is kind of blurry for all of us.
I think so. And I think for how sort of positive and confident and proud I am of the institution. I always felt like the career programming was kind of farcical. You know, it was like the college would hire the people who couldn't get jobs to teach you about how to get a job so they could boost the numbers of graduates that had jobs.
Yeah.
It was just kind of silly. And then I think when you say, is it worth it, you have to ask, like, worth what? Financially, was it worth $160,000? I mean, I don't know. I probably haven't made $160,000 in the past 4 years.
It's okay. I haven't either.
I went to Wellesley College. I think it was a great place. And I saw the other day their tuition for the incoming class and almost spit out my drink.
That's Betsy Stevenson.
I'm actually reading about the Fed right now.
And that is Justin Wolfers.
The committee's members concurred that the date given in the statement would be subject to revision in response to significant changes.
Justin's obviously heard that sketch where the whole point of NPR is to bore people into submission.
Stevenson and Wolfers may sound a bit familiar. We've had them on our program before, and they write for the Freakonomics blog. They also happen to live together.
We start with co-authors, then we move on to having offices next to each other, but yes, we also share a home, a life, and a child.
They are both college professors, both economists, and both of them in the neighborhood of 40 years old. And over the course of their careers, they have seen the cost of college climb and climb.
I mean, it is true that the prices have just gone up a lot more than the prices of food, the prices of other sort of goods.
Maybe not gold, but I can't think of any other things that have kept pace with tuition inflation.
I think a key distinction people need to make is between sticker price and actual prices being paid. And all of our alarm is about the rising sticker prices. And I have no doubt that the prices that people are actually paying, which is, you know, after scholarships and financial aid and all these different ways we can help, I have no doubt that's going up, but it's not going up at anywhere near the rate that the sticker price is going up.
And it's not surprising that a bunch, particularly of the private schools, have increased the generosity of their aid program. So it's not surprising that their top-end prices would go up to help make that balance.
So let's think about the school I know best, which is Harvard, my alma mater. The cost of going to Harvard for a working-class kid has never been lower. It's zero. So that's a case where the sticker price is enormously high. The actual price being paid for a working-class kid is enormously much lower.
And what's the incentive for the institution to make public a sticker price that's so out of whack with the actual price for a certain kind of student?
I actually think it's wonderful that Harvard has raised its sticker price. Very few people pay the sticker price, only the kids of the super rich, the people who get none of this financial aid and assistance and so on. So the higher sticker price is essentially increasing price discrimination. We're charging the rich more for college. The question we really need to ask ourselves, are we charging the working and the middle class more or less? That's a much, much harder question, though, and the sticker price tells you very little about that.
So this is a great and important point you're making, but I just want to know, where do we find that number?
You call real education economists, not me.
Uh-huh.
I'm Ronald Ehrenberg. I'm a professor at Cornell University, where I also direct the Cornell Higher Education Research Institute.
Ronald Ehrenberg is a real education economist.
We should distinguish between the sticker price, the posted price that students are supposed to pay, and the net tuition, which is the price that they pay once you take account of grant aid from the federal government and state governments, institutional aid, and also tax credits that are provided by the federal government. And although the sticker price has gone up at very, very rapid rates, the rates of increase in the net tuition, what students actually pay, on average has been somewhat more modest.
Okay, but still, in most cases, net tuition prices have gone up too, a lot. So we asked Ehrenberg, where is all that money going?
The answer is really that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Economists are very fond of saying that education currently is a highly labor-intensive industry, and there has not been great productivity growth.
Allow me to translate from economist speak. College is a labor-intensive industry because it involves real human beings, professors in this case, doing a real task in real time, which means you can't just flip a switch and churn out more students. Unless, of course, you're talking about online education, which is starting to change the college landscape, but let's not get into that for now. So if you want more productivity, you have to hire more people or pay the same people more money.
So this money all comes in, and the major thing that it pays for are faculty and staff salaries.
And don't forget health care, which is a huge part of anybody's salary. So it's a complex situation, and there are lots of nuances, like the difference between private and public schools.
In private higher education, when tuitions go up, it's usually because the private institutions are spending more on their students. But in public higher education, when tuitions go up, expenditures per student often go down because in the public sector, tuition increases are often efforts to try to make up for cutbacks in state support.
So that's the supply side. What do we know about the demand side, the students? Here are some numbers. Roughly two-thirds of students attending college today receive some kind of financial aid, grants, loans, scholarships, education tax credits, and so on. And how much does that aid help? Well, about two-thirds of the students who graduate do so with debt, and their average debt is about $23,000. Now, that's not a trivial amount, but if the returns to education are as big as economists say they are, well, the math can still work. So for a family thinking about sending a kid to college but struggling with the cost, it might help to think a bit like an economist, to think about stretching your dollars. Here, once again, is David Card.
You don't have to live in the dorm. You can live with your parents, which is what they do in all of Europe. You don't have to go to the elite private school. You can go to the best public school you can get into. And, you know, it's the reality today is the majority of kids going to college are working part-time.
So for the most part, this seems like good news. The returns to education are huge, and college, despite some serious tuition inflation, doesn't cost as much as it may seem, at least relative to its value. So does that mean that everyone should go to college?
I think that people often make the mistake of not thinking through the problem as systematically and thoroughly as an economist would advise. So first of all, there are two major costs of college. Everybody thinks about tuition. But there's another equally important cost, and that's the opportunity cost of not working. So when you go to college, you're going to forego working a job that's going to pay you some kind of salary. And while lots of students have part-time jobs or try to fit some kind of work on while they're in college, they're obviously not doing the kind of work that they would be doing if they didn't go to college.
Because, right, as you describe it, I mean, let's just imagine this mythical 18-year-old kid who thinks about it and says, okay, I'm going to go spend 4 years and probably a whole lot of someone's money and to produce an outcome that is not quite clear to me versus I'm going to start tomorrow doing this thing that I am already pretty good at and I think I could be great at. That strikes me as a harder dilemma, a tougher dilemma than I think most of us think about. So how do you go around thinking through that muddle?
So, Stephen, I'm going to surprise you. I was that guy. I finished high school in Australia, and my great passion in life at the time was horse racing. I wanted to either become a professional gambler or a bookie when I grew up. And so when I finished school, I was not going to go to college. I thought exactly, what am I going to learn in 4 years at college that I couldn't learn being on the first rung of what I saw as a career path. I had a bookmaker who was going to mentor me, and I thought that this was going to be a career I would really enjoy.
And we should say it's and the legality of bookmaking privately in Australia versus here is what?
So in Australia, bookmaking is legal. So this would have been a legal career path.
Very good.
I was one of those natural experiments. I was very lucky. I got fired 2.5 weeks. Actually, it was 1.5 weeks into my first job. And at that point, I shrugged my shoulders and thought, what the heck, I'll just go to college now, I've got something to do.
So when you see these numbers, when you see such low, relatively low unemployment, the more education you have, when you see relatively more money, earning more money, the more education you have, do you ever wonder, how can there possibly be a debate about the value of college?
Well, the debate is about, is it worth it for the marginal kid? And if it is, what should they be doing? What, you know, where, what should they be studying? Why is it going to matter for them? And so if you're trying to figure out for an individual kid what's going to be the return for them, I think it's a lot harder.
Yeah, so if you had to grade some of the exams I've had to grade, the worst kid in my class is the marginal kid. And that kid, most of my students are outstanding, spectacular. They learn a lot. Their exams are brilliant. But the students right at the bottom, it's not clear they understood a word I said. And so I think, you know, if the alternative is casual work, retail jobs, dead-end jobs, going-nowhere jobs, then I would say I'd look any 18-year-old kid in the eye and say, you know, 4 more years of this isn't taking you anywhere. 4 more years of college may well take you somewhere. For kids who are going to start a trade, apprentices and the like, for whom 4 years in the workforce is going to be an investment in their future, there I think it's a lot harder. I think if I had a kid who was good with their hands and not academically inclined and they could find a good apprenticeship, sure, I'd encourage them to follow that.
So Wolfers and Stevenson aren't arguing that college is right for every kid, but what about their kid? Their daughter, Matilda, is 3 years old. And what happens if 15 years from now she has a different idea?
Well, this is a great question because while I like her to think about there being choices in the world...
She has no choice in this matter.
I do not want her to grow up thinking about whether college is a choice. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when you said you were going to ask me that question, it made me a little nervous. I was like, I don't want her to listen to a radio interview where she hears this discussed as an option.
Yeah.
I would be very disappointed if she chose not to go that path.
Your question also comes a little late. Matilda actually reassured me the other day just before bath time. Daddy, I'm going to college.
Coming up, Steve Levitt tries to explain the magic that happens in a college classroom. Or maybe it's not in the classroom.
And it's kind of hard when you watch it to figure out where it is that the value is added.
This podcast of Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud financial management and business analytics technology. Host Analytics has been helping to drive businesses' decisions for over a decade by streamlining customers' budgeting, planning, and financial reporting processes with little or no IT overhead. More information and access to the results of a finance executive survey at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Economists tell us that college is good for us, and not just in terms of higher pay. People who go to college tend to be healthier, happier, they tend to live longer. So we know that college works somehow, but how? What exactly does college do to produce all those gains? Here's Justin Wolfers again.
It's clear to me that college is a good choice for many. It's much less clear to me why. I do the best I can when I teach, but it's not clear that anything I teach the kids is going to make them better business people or better members of the economy or more productive. It's not obvious it wouldn't. And then I think about my own experience. Well, I went to college with a bunch of really smart people, so maybe it's all peer effects, in which case we can just get the professors out. And maybe that's a big part of it. Maybe it's expectations. So maybe the important thing that I demonstrate for my students is not that demand curves slope down and supply curves slope up, but I expect them to go on and do great things. I'm not really sure what it is. I just know there are effects.
Steve Levitt has spent the past quarter century on college campuses, either as a student or a professor. And since he specializes in solving economic mysteries, I went to him with the question.
Personally, I have to say I don't know anything about that. And I watched the college production function. I watch us produce college students here at the University of Chicago. I was a college student being produced. And it's kind of hard when you watch it to figure out where it is that the value is added. When obviously I teach my students, I teach them very specific things. But I know that when I talk to them years later, they don't remember anything that I taught them. I mean, I can ask them the most simple questions about the material we covered, and they have no recollection whatsoever, the typical student. So
I'm curious. I mean, you teach at least one really big class each year, right? The economics of crime is a pretty big class.
100 students, not huge.
And then occasionally smaller classes, yeah?
Yeah, mostly for the graduate students. I teach small classes, 15 or 20 students.
Okay, so over your years of you've been teaching college for how long? More than like 12, 15 years? 15 yeah. years. Okay, so you've seen a couple thousand people come through, and obviously you can't know much about too many of them. But if you think about your role as a professor trying to teach people, you know, how to think, how to learn to think about things, problem solving and so on, what's just your personal observation of when you've been successful at that or how often you think you may have been successful at helping that?
Well, I would say about 5 of those students have later written me and said, hey, you really helped me learn how to think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the only direct evidence I have. I give them exams. A lot of my exams are about how to think. A counterargument to what I'm saying about teaching kids how to think is that the returns that students get from other kinds of education, so real actual skills like trade schools, I think – there are real returns. So I did a study many years back that looked at Chicago public schools, and it turned out that the single biggest impact of school choice in the Chicago schools was giving kids who are not doing well in the traditional kinds of schools the opportunity to go to trade culinary school or schools that actually taught them real skills. So clearly you can see how going to school to learn real skills like nursing or something like that could have huge returns. The tougher question is these general liberal arts education, what are you learning? And it's something economists haven't even tried to really think about very much.
I'm Biddy Martin. I'm president of Amherst College.
Biddy Martin is not an economist. Before becoming an administrator, she was a professor of German and women's studies. But as a college president, she's thought a lot about the power of education and what happens to people during those 4 years. Martin herself grew up in rural Virginia. Her family expected her to go to high school and do well, but college was another issue.
The family was skeptical of education. They worried about the impact of a college education, especially on girls. They made it clear to me that it was more important for boys to be educated than for me. They grew up in a time and a place when the bias against what they would have called eggheads and overly educated people included, among other things, I think, a fear that people with a lot of education think they're better than those who don't have an education. So they had a fear about being looked down on, I think. They had a fear of loss, that is, the loss of children who go off to college and begin to think differently, and as they used to say to me, talk differently. We didn't raise you to talk like that. who actually move geographically to other parts of the country. They became afraid in the late 60s and early 70s of the impact that college might have on my political views.
In high school, Martin had a guidance counselor who encouraged her to apply to college. And over time, her family came around to the idea, even supported her. But their fear that she would change never really went away. And in retrospect, they were kind of right.
I left home and I didn't return to live in that area. I made choices about my life, the kind of work I wanted to do, the people I wanted to be with, that were hard for them, and they never ceased being hard for them. It's impossible to learn a completely different way of thinking about things without unlearning what one has already learned. And I think it's important to realize that, because it's often the case now, people think about education as the acquisition of new things, as if it were an unproblematic and promising process simply of adding to what one already knows or thinks. And the truth is, it is transformative. And that means upending a whole set of assumptions about how to see things, what's possible, what's real.
I recently visited my undergraduate alma mater, Appalachian State University, and I caught up with a few of my favorite professors, including Joe Murphy, who taught and still teaches documentary filmmaking. If you asked me whether I learned a lot from Joe Murphy, I'd say that absolutely I did. If you asked me what I learned, that's a lot harder to say. So I asked Joe to describe, from his perspective, what happens to a kid who goes to college.
Well, I think the best thing people can learn in college is to not be afraid of the new or the different. You know, that these people come to the college, or most people come to college with a fairly walled off background of experience. You know, they come from a high school in a small town, even a high school in a city. They don't know many people. They haven't met many different kinds of racial, ethnic groups, or they haven't been exposed to ideas that are radically different from their parents' ideas. And so what I hope they take away from college, and I think the better ones do, is an openness to other people, other ideas, you know, diversity, the great diversity that's in life.
Yeah. I'll tell you, that's what happened to me. Even a place like Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina, which you would think would be pretty homogenous, some of the best friends I made here happened to be guys on the soccer team. There were the Nigerians and Keith Lane from Ghana and my good friend Greg Cuddy from Ireland, who unfortunately has passed away. And I mean, it was a UN in the middle of the North Carolina. It was bizarre. No expectation of that. So to me, coming down, all these people were these wildly worldly people.
I guess the negative part for me is people who come to college to accumulate credit hours, and all they're really interested in doing is getting a degree, because you can definitely get a degree here and know nothing, unfortunately, as I think you can anywhere. And it's sad to see young people who set such a low standard for themselves. That's, to me, crushing. Somebody that's 18, 19, 20 years old, and because chances are good that they're going to live that way the rest of their lives, you know? I was a majored in economics. The reason I majored in economics, I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a strange reason to major in something?
You think that happens less these days?
Absolutely. I mean, people major in what they think will get them a job. You know, they major in business because they think it'll get them a job.
Do you blame them for that?
No, I don't. You know, college is very expensive. And people are insisting on some measure to prove to them that their $100,000 investment or $40,000 investment is worth it. And I can understand that. I mean, that's a lot of money. But in reality, I don't think there is a way to quantify the value of college. I mean, I know you can look at statistics about people that have a college education or better paid. And I think you have to look at quality of life issues. You know, people, to me, ignorance breeds hatred. And if you can get people knowledgeable, they'll be less hatred, more understanding. That's my theory.
It's a question I've been asking myself a lot lately, if it's worth it or not to go to college.
College is definitely worth it. Without an education, no one can go far. It doesn't matter what you decide to do.
Just being even, like, be able to socialize and become a mature person so when you hit the workforce, you're not as immature as you are when you came out of high school.
Higher education, like, is the best thing, and I think, like, a human being is nothing without, like, education.
I choose to go to college because I want to advance myself. I need a good family. I need a good job. I need a well-paid job. So if I'm educated, gradually those things will come away.
I'm not going to college to make more money, interestingly enough. I'm actually here because this stuff interests me.
When I really look back at what I've done, I'm about to graduate, and I really didn't do a thing. I really just want to be happy. I don't, whatever that means. I mean, if that means 30 grand a year or 300 grand a year, I just want to be happy.
If I could redo the past four years, I maybe wouldn't go to college right away, if at all.
Is college worth it? Of course, man. Without knowledge, there's no progress. We're all students in the end, you know. No one's bigger than nobody.
If you can find a way to do it big without going to school, then props to you, but we haven't done that yet. We're here. We're here for the long haul, so it's good.
Economics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Catherine Wells. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, David Herman, Beret Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Jake Smith is our intern. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Coming up on our next podcast, you know you've dreamed about it, working from home. But would you actually get any work done, or would you just watch cat videos all day? We'll tell you.
Fall registration for Henry Ford Community College is underway, with a wide variety of programs and degree options to choose from. Let HFCC guide you on your way to higher education. For more information, contact the Office of Registration and Records by calling 313-845-6403 or online at hfcc.edu.
Would it be crazy if you just stopped everything, packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year? What if you left for 2 years? Would people think you'd lost your mind? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? A village crowded with Buddhist temples, not skyscrapers. A place where there isn't a word for recluse, but 1,000 words for community. Would it be crazy to go 5,000 miles from home? To spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about? To build libraries and fill them with stories? Prepare a meal with food you helped grow? To teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself? Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFCC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
This is Mr. White, and I'm offering you the opportunity to have as much fun as I do every Thursday at noon on the Blues Time. So tune in to 89.3, be happy as you can be, or get online and listen to the Blues Time, the world's greatest blues show on Thursday at noon. So get groovy.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotel.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Luke Tipple, marine biologist and shark diving expert. And we'll also hear from Marianne Hitt from the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign about some of the major victories they've had in the past year. Luke Tipple, marine biologist and shark diving expert, joins us today to talk about Shark Week on the Discovery Channel. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Luke, the first question that you probably always get is, how did you become a shark diver? Is that the kind of thing you dreamed of as a kid? I mean, it's an unusual career path, but a very exciting one.
It is. And, you know, the actual term shark diver it's kind of like an industry term that's picked up its own life, and people identify that as a career now, which is kind of strange to me, to be honest. I first was entranced with sharks when I was a kid. I remember being 4 or 5 years old, diving with my dad and seeing sharks. They were just little Port Jackson sharks, or little wobbegongs, completely harmless sharks. But to me, they were the biggest, coolest things on the planet. And he'd show me them in the water, and then I'd see Jacques Cousteau out on the water. And I always grew up with Cousteau and Attenborough as my heroes. You know, I wanted to be those guys and get out and make documentaries and see the natural world and to interact with big animals, particularly in the ocean. That led me to the natural path of pursuing a degree and career in marine biology. And after that, I focused on sharks. And I've just been, fortunate for sure, but worked very hard on focusing on the animals that I feel particularly passionate about, and that is sharks.
And so when did you have your first, shark diving experience, not with the little harmless sharks that you might see in the reef, but actually, the larger sharks that folks are more scared of?
We used to see whaler sharks and the occasional great white all the time in South Australia where I was growing up. We'd see them, off in the distance when we were spearfishing or surfing, but I never really sort of got down and worked with them and interacted with them until I moved to the Barrier Reef way up north. I took my degree at James Cook University in Townsville and had a job as a dive master on the weekend. So it was pretty ideal. I'd, 5 days a week I'd be at college learning about marine bio. Then on the weekend I'd go out and dive some of the most beautiful reef systems in the world, and had frequent interactions with sharks there. And that's where I really knew, okay, this is for me. I'd see a bull shark or a couple of times drop into feeding frenzies or some more heightened scenarios.
What do you love most about sharks? What do you think is the most amazing about them?
The ocean feels like a home to me, but I'm very cognizant of the fact that we are visitors. We are completely, out of our depth when we come to the ocean. We can do all types of things to make ourselves safer in the ocean and to make it more accessible to us through diving technologies and different machinery and personal fitness and everything else. But in the end, we're visitors in that ecosystem. And what really fascinates me about sharks is they haven't needed to change and evolve for so long. They really hit that perfection in their niche. And I just love seeing that perfection in an animal, particularly when they're at the apex of their ecosystem. They really are an important link in the ocean's health. And besides that, let's face it, I'm a guy, I'm a geek, and sharks are cool. I've always thought they're the coolest things around, and that's been reinforced by my interactions and work with them.
Now, I read on your website that you're one of the few people who has had the experience of intentionally swimming unprotected with great white sharks, so no shark cage. Tell us about that experience.
That's something that should never be taken lightly. It's an awesome experience. I worked for, about 6 years running a shark diving service. I was worked for a very long time and still do with Patrick Douglas of sharkdiver.com, and he actually brought me in as his dive master. So I was running his back deck and working with great whites. And after a number of years of observing the sharks from the cage and the surface and really getting to know their mannerisms, I started thinking, well, we need to get closer. Filming from the cage was not as exciting as it used to be. I guess I always liked to find out how to push the limits, and I really wanted to get in the water and swim with them to get better shots. And, you know, we've made a few productions to show that sharks aren't necessarily the killing machines that many people believe them to be. They are very approachable. You just have to know their body language and how, in assuming the risks of being in the water, there is actually a relatively, I won't say safe, but a lower risk way of interacting with sharks. And the great whites are a great example. As long as you know how to approach them, I've swam quite comfortably alongside 17-foot great white sharks before with no real concern to my safety. My heart was beating fast, surely. First time I did it was a little bit hairy, purely because, you know, it's a big animal and you just want to be safe. But we've developed a level of comfort with these animals over the years, and I feel very privileged to have done so.
Speaking of cages, in Shark Week on the Discovery Channel this year, you swim in this special shark cage that's constructed to look like a Volkswagen Beetle because they're one of the sponsors. Tell us about that. It's an unusual idea. How did that originate? And when I looked at the images, it looks like the bars are actually quite far apart. I mean, was it still safe? It seems like the sharks might be able to get at you in there.
Well, the concept was originally brought to me as they asked if I could build a VW Beetle shark cage. And I said, well, yes, we can build a shark cage, but how about we build something really cool instead? Because as you probably know, a lot of my work is done outside the cage. Cages have their uses and applications when diving with sharks. A lot of people need the safety of cages, especially amateurs. And sometimes they're very useful for things like launching camera systems and doing more high-risk tagging things. But most of the time, I'm outside the cage. So I said, well, look, if I'm going to be involved in this, let's create something that is not only cool, but also better represents the Volkswagen Beetle. You know, it's a car. It can drive fast. It's a cool vehicle. Let's make something that identifies that underwater. So my idea was to make it move. So we built what I call the shark observation vehicle. It's not really a cage as far as I see it. It does function in that way, but it's not, you know, your typical shark completely safe cage. You're right, the bars are intentionally spaced further apart. There's a couple of reasons for that. We really wanted to make it look like the Volkswagen Beetle and to really stay true to its form and its lines and stay true to the actual brand that we're representing. But I also didn't want to close it all down. I wanted a sense of space about it that also helped the hydrodynamics and the way that we were able to move through the water. I didn't want, you know, bars on where the windscreen would be. I didn't want a windscreen in there. All those open spaces just allowed water to flow around rather than being restricted to the forward movement of the vehicle. And drag was something we thought very seriously about. As far as it functioning as a shark cage, I'm able to drive it around underwater, and the sharks keep a respectful distance from it because they can feel a metal structure there. So sharks aren't really looking at that construction and saying, oh, where can I get in? Mm-hmm. They're more worried about, there's a big object there and I'm going to swim around it. But I was able to push all the walls down, so they ended up actually underneath me, but they still hung vertically. So it was like an inverted cage, and I'm standing on what would be the floor that is actually kind of the roof. And to a shark, that's still a huge structure. It still feels all that metal there, and it chooses to swim around it because it feels that obstruction. I can be standing on it, and in actual fact, I'm completely unprotected except for what's underneath my feet. But to a shark, it's a great big obstruction, and they are very respectful of obstructions underwater. They're a free-swimming animal. They don't like to get trapped, and generally they swim around.
Now, do they avoid the cage because it's metal or just because it's very large? Can they tell that you are separate from the object, or does it just look like, do they avoid, if you're standing on top of a cage, would they avoid it because they just think that you're some huge creature?
You know, that's a very good question. When I wasn't inside the SOV, We looked at the sharks, and they were swimming around quite close to it, quite comfortably, with really no fear of it. They certainly weren't swimming through it, but they were swimming around it. As soon as I stepped into the vehicle, they had a living life form to fixate on. So they, you know, sharks will swim by and look you in the eye and see what your reaction is. Once I fired up the thrusters, it was actually an interesting phenomenon because the initial startup of the thrusters creates a huge magnetic field, and the sharks were initially repelled by that. So I could see them, you know, they'd be swimming close, I'd start up the thrusters and they'd kick away, almost kind of startled. But then once the thrusters are running, they're actually attracted to that magnetic field. So they'd kick away and then they'd come back and go, "Ooh, what is that?" and they're actually literally following me around. I'd be driving around underwater, I'd turn around and there's a bunch of sharks on my tail. It was a really cool experience.
What does it feel like to have a shark swim by and actually look you in the eye?
It's a great feeling, you know, to interact with any wild animal, you know, be it on land or sea, is something that I have great respect for. Particularly when wild animals choose to come close to you, there's that level of, while we are still visitors, there is that level of kind of acceptance, but also assessment. You know, you're definitely aware that they're trying to figure out what are you and at what level are you. You know, are you a threat? Are you a fellow predator? Are you prey? And these are things that top predators look for. So if you're exhibiting predatory behavior or competitive behavior, there's a good chance they're going to leave you alone because they don't want to be injured. If you're looking like prey, behaving like prey, they may be just more interested in you. So to me, it's that real sort of privileged feeling of having that interaction, but also that I'm glad you're paying attention to me because I can show you that I'm not on your menu. Look at me, work with me, be aware that I'm exhibiting behaviors that aren't conducive to you thinking that I'm lower on the food chain than you, and let's have a respect for each other underwater.
What do you think our listeners would be most surprised to learn about sharks?
Well, for those shark fans out there, they're probably not so surprised to hear that, you know, sharks are oversold as monsters. To those who aren't really familiar with sharks, they'd be really surprised to know that sharks are really smart. They're very intelligent animals. They're very instinctive and predatory animals, absolutely. But they don't take risks. They really look for feeding opportunities that are lower risk to them. They can't afford to get injured. You know, a shark, depending on the species, of course, but generally takes, you know, 10, 12, 15 years of growing up before it can even reproduce. And when it does reproduce, it generally reproduces in fairly small numbers. So we're talking about an animal that has to survive and has to stick around and be smart in order to contribute to its population and its species. And really, that's the only intention of wild animals, is to contribute and propagate. I run into this misconception with people where they believe that, you know, sharks are unintelligent eating machines and they go after any opportunity, and therefore they put them in that kind of monsterish category. And that's certainly not helped by media coverage that we see when you know, they demonize the sharks. But they're really not that way. You know, it's a really unfortunate thing when we have a negative interaction with sharks. You know, if a person gets bitten or dies from a shark, I'm really sympathetic to that. Obviously, it's a horrible scenario. But no more so than a tragic accident on the roadway or some other situation where we've knowingly put ourselves at risk. The interactions that people generally have with sharks, which are way more frequent than the negative interactions, are generally fairly passive. The shark will see the person in the water. The person probably isn't even aware of it, and it'll move on because it doesn't see a feeding opportunity. It's not familiar with us as a food source, and it'll pass us on by. And that happens every day when people are in the ocean. Unfortunately, the only time we hear about it is when it goes wrong.
I remember we had a documentary filmmaker on our show a number of years ago who made a film called Shark Water. I don't know if you've seen it. And one thing that he said that stuck with me was that people think of sharks as being very dangerous, but very few people actually die from shark attacks. I think that what he said was that more people in the U.S. actually die from accidents where a vending machine will fall on them when they're trying to get their money back than from a shark attack. I mean, it's not very common, and yet the way in which we have villainized and demonized sharks has led to a lot of problems in terms of conservation issues to protect them, don't you think?
That is true. You know, we can pull a number of very weird statistics about things that kill more people than sharks, and, you know, coconuts falling on heads and vending machines are two of those which really sort of resonate with people. To me, they don't resonate as much because it is a different scenario. When people get hit or get attacked in the water, generally they They're not prepared for it. They're not aware that they're in that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
They're very surprised. You know, if somebody gets killed by a coconut dropping out of a tree or a vending machine falls on them, there's not that necessary level of surprise. It's like, oh, well, he shouldn't have been climbing on that vending machine. You know, that was a danger he knowingly put himself into. But we as humans have disassociated our, you know, emergence from the ocean and lack of ability to, you know, to breathe and see and move very quickly through the water. People still think that we should be able to own that water because we're so used to being the dominant apex species on the planet. But the fact is, we don't belong in the water as mm-hmm. much as I like to think that I do, and many people do. As a human being, we don't actually really belong in the water there. That's their domain. And people enter the water not really thinking that way. And consequently, when we get attacked, they're very, very surprised. And there's a level of shock and anger that goes along with that. Almost that they're offended, I think, that anything could catch them unawares like that. And it's unique to the ocean. We don't get that type of reaction if someone's walking around in, you know, in a jungle and gets attacked by a tiger. You know, we almost let people be the person at fault in that case. Like, well, you shouldn't have been walking around with lions, right? It's very much the same with the ocean. However, people are becoming more forgiving of that type of scenario, and we are seeing a lot of great conservation efforts and people who've been attacked, you know, stepping up for the shark and saying, well, you know, I know that I was in there, that environment. I know that I was potentially at risk. It's such a low risk, but the risk is there. I was aware, I was cognizant of it. And sharks don't need to be targeted or demonized for something that they're naturally built to do and that we've actually put ourselves in that scenario for it to happen.
Last question for you. Why are sharks so important for protecting our oceans? And what are some of the most important conservation issues facing sharks today? And how can Shark Week on the Discovery Channel help to raise awareness about the need to protect them?
Very, very simple. Sharks are the top of a very complex food chain. And they're necessary to keep the numbers of lower order and high breeding species in check. The biggest problems that we're seeing is by far and away the desire and the demand for shark fin soup, particularly by Asian countries. We're seeing very unsustainable numbers of sharks being pulled from the ocean on a daily rate. The best studies have shown anywhere from 30 to 70 million sharks. I think it's actually like 32 to 74 million sharks per year taken out of the ocean. And we're seeing that as a very unsustainable rate. Most of the sharks that are higher in the predatory scale are actually at risk or endangered.
If 30 million sharks are being killed each year for shark fin soup, mm-hmm. what are the estimates for how many sharks there are in the oceans today?
That's one of the problems that we're facing. There's no way to really set a sustainable rate of shark fishing without knowing how many are left.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the arguments that is often purported by opponents of regulating shark fishing is that, well, we still see tons of sharks around, so obviously it doesn't matter the number you're taking out as long as it's sustainable. But more and more and more studies, particularly on certain species, are showing that we're not seeing the numbers necessary to keep the oceans healthy. We're seeing that in degrading ecosystems, like reef systems that aren't supporting themselves anymore because they've removed the top apex predators. We're seeing large fisheries that are starting to fail. And the removal of sharks is one of the symptoms that is causing that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we can do, you know, just as anybody, you know, a lot of this seems to be very far away. It's offshore. You know, we have this kind of stigma of, well, it's Asian shark fin fisheries that are causing this problem. I can't do anything about it. That's all the way over there. Well, there is things that you can do about it. You can support businesses that reduce or regulate shark fishing. You know, you can support marinas that don't support shark fishing. You can, when you visit restaurants, make sure they're not serving shark products, shark fin soup particularly. But, you know, if you see shark on the menu, I'd encourage you not to give your business to that business because in some way they are contributing to what is probably an unsustainable take of that species. Now, there is a few exceptions to that. There are a few regulated and fairly well-monitored shark fisheries around. The black-tip shark in Florida is one where some very good and current science is showing that the regulated fishing on that species is actually sustainable. But by far and large, the larger targeted sharks, you know, the great whites, the tigers, the the Makos in many parts of the world, the blue sharks, the whale sharks, they're all being taken at highly unsustainable rates, largely for their fins. The bodies are generally discarded, which is, you know, not a very nice thing, of course, but the demand for that shark fin is highly severe, and it's something that we're going to see very big implications from if we can't reduce that trade in the very near future. And supporters of Shark Week and shark conservation can definitely help by, you know, supporting the groups that are trying to stop that.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Luke Tipple, marine biologist and shark diving expert. And for more information, you can go to his website at luketipple.com. Marianne Hitt joins us today from the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign to talk about the one-year anniversary of their part.
The pollution that causes climate disruption. And we're largely doing that because we're reducing our use of coal. So it's a surprising bright spot in what otherwise can sometimes be a pretty scary and overwhelming issue. And it's also a success story that you can attribute to the hard work of ordinary people in their communities.
I think that's what's so inspiring and amazing about the story is that a lot of people are feeling despondent about climate disruption and feel like the United States has shirked its responsibility and isn't doing enough. But the truth is, even though we didn't get a climate bill at the federal level, these changes are happening. And it's dedicated citizens at the local level that are really changing the entire shape of not only the energy infrastructure of this country, but also our ability to actually protect the planet from huge amounts of climate disruption.
It's true. When Mayor Bloomberg announced his partnership with the Sierra Club, one of the reasons he cited for joining with us was that he felt like true change always comes not from Washington, but from cities and states and local levels where people have to deal with air pollution and water pollution, and they've got to get cleaned up or their lives are going to be intolerable. And so they can't be satisfied with platitudes from Washington. They've got to solve problems. And that was why Mayor Bloomberg, one of the reasons he partnered with Sierra Club and our Beyond Coal campaign. And I think over the past year, while we have been working together with this partnership with Bloomberg Philanthropies, we have proven time and time again that that is indeed where change is coming from, and we don't have to wait for Washington, that people in their communities can switch from coal to clean energy, and they can do that in ways that clean up air pollution, clean up water pollution, improve their property values, their quality of life, and also leave a better world for future generations.
Tell us about specific examples of places where a coal plant has been retired and actually opened up the space for clean energy.
Announced they were going to be retiring that plant because of environmental concerns, because of the costs of running the plant. And they initially were going to replace it with a small amount of solar, but when they put out their request for proposals and started getting
WHFR,
the bids in from the solar companies, the solar was so cheap that they decided to go much bigger, and they're now on target to actually build one of the largest solar projects in the world that's going to not only replace a lion's share of that coal plant, but employ a lot of the workers from the coal plant. And so we are seeing that as these old and outdated coal plants that are due for retirement are finally phased out, that indeed does open up market share for clean energy. And we're seeing clean energy now being deployed across the country at record levels. It's truly inspiring.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Marianne Hitt. She's the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. And for more information, you can visit beyondcoal.org.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at Sierra Club Radio.